You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of Mystics After Modernism, Discovering the Seeds of a New Science in the Renaissance by Rudolf Steiner. This is section 5 on Agrippa of Nettesheim and Theophrastus Paracelsus. Heinrich Cornelius Agrippa of Nettesheim and Theophrastus Paracelsus followed the path indicated by the thought of Nicholas of Cusa. Footnote: Heinrich Cornelius Agrippa of Nettesheim, 1486 to 1535, German physician, theologian, and philosopher. After serving in the army of Emperor Maximilian I, he became a lecturer and historiographer of Emperor Charles V. He published, titled De Occulta Philosophia, 1531, a cosmology based on Kabbalistic and Pythagorean analyses and magic, which helped link his name to the legend of Faust. He rejected all scientific knowledge in favor of simple biblical piety. Theophrastus Paracelsus, parenthesis Bombast von Hohenheim, 1493 to 1541, German alchemist and physician, born in Einsiedeln, Switzerland. He investigated the mechanics of mining, minerals, and diseases of miners in the mines of Tyrol. He wandered Europe, Russia, and the Middle East. He was forced from the University of Basel for his defiance of tradition, choosing to lecture in German, and criticizing the classics. He opposed the humoral theory of disease, claiming instead that diseases are specific entities that can be cured by specific remedies. He emphasized the value of phenomenology, and was first to connect goiter with minerals and drinking water, describe psilocosis, and identify congenital syphilis. He introduced therapeutic mineral baths of opium, mercury, lead, sulfur, and so on, thus establishing chemistry's place in medical practice. End of footnote. They immersed themselves in nature, and, as comprehensively as possible, endeavored to explore its laws with all the means available at the time. In this knowledge of nature, they also saw the true foundation for all higher cognition. They themselves tried to develop that foundation from natural science by allowing science to be reborn in the spirit. Agrippa of Nettesheim led an eventful life. He was born in Cologne, the descendant of a noble family. He studied medicine and jurisprudence at an early age and informed himself about natural phenomena in the way that was customary of the time and within certain circles and societies, as well as through contact with several scholars who carefully kept secret whatever insights they gained into nature. To that end, he repeatedly went to Paris, Italy, and England, and he also visited the well-known abbot Trithemius of Spanheim in Würzburg. Footnote: Johannes Heidenberg, 1462 to 1516, also known as Johannes Trithemius, a German abbot and historian, abbot of Spanheim and of the Scottish monastery of St. Jakob in Würzburg. End of footnote. He taught in scientific institutions at various times, and here and there entered the services of rich and noble persons, at whose disposal he placed his talents as a statesman and scientist. His biographers describe the services he rendered as not always above reproach, and it is said that he acquired money under the pretext of being adept in secret arts, and of securing various advantages for people by means of these arts. If this is true, it is balanced by his unmistakable and ceaseless urge to acquire the entire scope of learning of his time honestly, and to deepen this knowledge in the spirit of a higher cognition of the world. He tried to gain a clear understanding of both natural science and higher cognition. Only one who has insight into the ways by which one achieves these two forms of cognition can attain such a goal. It is true that natural science must be lifted into the realm of spirit before it can lead to higher cognition. Likewise, it is true that initially it must remain in its own proper field so that it may provide the right foundation for a higher level of understanding. Quote, spirit in nature, close quote, exists only for spirit. As surely as nature is spiritual in this sense, it is equally certain that nothing perceived in nature by physical organs is directly spiritual. Nothing that is spirit can appear to my eye, EYE, as spirit. I must not seek spirit itself in nature. I do this when I interpret a process of the outer world in a directly spiritual way, as when, for example, I ascribe to plants a soul that is only remotely analogous to the human soul. I also do this when I ascribe a spatial or temporal existence to spirit or to soul itself. When, for example, I say of the eternal human soul that it lives in time without the body, but still in the manner of a body, rather than as pure spirit. And I do this even when I believe that the spirit of a deceased person can show itself in some sort of sensory perceptible manifestation. Spiritualism commits this error and shows merely that it has not understood the true nature of spirit, but simply wants to see spirit directly as a crude sensory manifestation. It fails to understand the nature of the senses or spirit. To consider spirit directly as something rare, surprising, and unusual, spiritualism deprives spirit of ordinary sensory phenomena, which occurs hour after hour before our eyes. It fails to understand that to someone with the capacity to see spirit, what lives as, quote, spirit in nature, close quote, reveals itself, for example, in the collision of two elastic spheres. The revelation of this spirit is not limited to processes that are remarkable because of their unusual nature and the fact that they cannot be grasped directly in their natural context. Furthermore, spiritualists draw the spirit down into a lower sphere. They do not explain a sensory perceptible phenomenon in space by means of those forces and beings that are in turn only spatial and available to the senses. Rather, they resort to, in quotes, spirits, which they then equate fully with what the senses perceive. This way of thinking is based on an insufficient capacity to comprehend spirit. One is incapable of viewing spirit in a spiritual way. Consequently, through mere sensory beings, one satisfies a need for spirit presence. To such people, spirit does not reveal spirit. This is why they look for it through the senses. They see clouds sailing through the air, and similarly they want to see spirits hurrying along. Agrippa of Nettesheim fought for a truly natural science that does not attempt to explain natural phenomena through spiritual beings who haunt the world of the senses, but instead sees only what is natural in nature, and only what is spiritual in spirit. Of course, it would be a complete misunderstanding of Agrippa to compare his natural science with that of later centuries, which has at its disposal completely different known facts. In such a comparison, it might easily seem that he still attributes the effects of natural causes or ideas based on erroneous information to the direct action of spirits. Moritz Carrière, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, it's spelled, this is the reader speaking, C-A-R-R-I-E-R-E, Carrière, maybe. Moritz Carrière does him this injustice when he says, though not with ill will, quote, Agrippa gives a long list of the things that belong to the sun, the moon, the planets or the fixed stars, and receive their influences. For instance, related to the sun are fire, blood, laurel, gold, topaz. They bestow the gift of the sun's courage, serenity, and light. The animals have a sense of nature that, more exalted than human reason, approaches the spirit of prophecy. People can be made to love and hate, to become sick and healthy. Thus one casts a spell upon thieves that prohibits them from stealing, prohibits merchants from trading, prohibits ships and mills from motion, and prevents lightning from striking. This is done with potions, salves, images, rings, and charms. The blood of hyenas or dragons is suitable for this purpose. One is reminded of Shakespeare's Cauldron of the Witches. Close quote. Footnote. Moritz Carrière, 1817-1895, French philosopher and aesthete. End of footnote. One is not reminded of it if one understands Agrippa correctly. He did, of course, believe ideas that were thought to be incontrovertible during his time. But we also do this today with regard to what is called factual, in quotes. Are we to believe that future centuries will not cast much of what we have established as irrefutable facts into the closet of blind superstition? It is true that I am convinced that there is real progress in human knowledge. Once the, in quotes, fact that the earth is round had been discovered, all earlier suppositions were banished into the realm of superstition. So it is with certain truths of astronomy, biology, and so on. The doctrine of natural descent, in comparison with all earlier hypotheses of creation, represents progress that is similar to the idea of a round earth compared to previous assumptions about its shape. Nevertheless, I am aware that in our learned scientific works and treatises, there are many so-called facts that will not appear as facts to future centuries, any more than much of what was maintained by Agrippa and Paracelsus does today. It is not a question of what they considered to be facts, but of the spirit in which they interpreted these facts. In Agrippa's time, one found little comprehension of the, quote, natural magic, close quote, that he advocated, which seeks what is natural in nature and only what is spiritual in spirit. People held on to the supernatural magic that seeks spirit in the realm of the senses, which Agrippa fought against. This is why Abbot Trithemius of Spanheim advised him to communicate his views as a secret doctrine only to a chosen few, who were able to rise to a similar view of nature and spirit. We give oxen only hay, not sugar, as we do to songbirds. It is perhaps this abbot to whom Agrippa owes the right viewpoint. In his Steganographia, Trithemius treats, with veiled irony, the way of thinking that confuses nature with spirit. In this book he seems to speak entirely about supernatural phenomena. One who reads it as it is must conclude that the author is speaking of conjuring spirits, of their flight through the air, and so on. But if one omits certain words and letters in the text, there remains letters that, when assembled into words, describe purely natural phenomena, parenthesis, as Wolfgang Ernst Heidel showed in 1676, close parenthesis. Footnote, Wolfgang Ernst Heidel, counselor to the Archbishop of Mainz, claimed to have decoded the third book of the trilogy, but Heidel caused dismay by encrypting his solution, causing many to dismiss his claim. Ultimately, Trithemius, quote, ultimately Trithemius' sleight of hand was effective. People believe what they read. If Trithemius said his technique relied on talismans and planetary spirits, that's what people believed. Close quote, end of footnote. Parenthesis. In one case, for example, in a formula of incantation, one must completely omit the first and last words and then cross out every other word, starting with the second. In the remaining words, one must cross out every other letter, starting with the first. One then assembles into words that which remains, and the formula of incantation is transformed into a communication of a purely natural meaning. Close parenthesis. How difficult it was for Agrippa to work his way out of the prejudices of his time and rise to a clear view is established by the fact that he did not allow his title De Occulta Philosophia to be published until 1531. He had composed it as early as 1510, but considered it immature. Further evidence of his reticence is provided by his work titled De Vanitate Scientiarum, in which he speaks bitterly of the scientific and general activity of his time. There he says very clearly that he had liberated himself only with difficulty from the delusion of those who see direct spiritual processes in external events, prophetic hints about the future in outer facts, and so on. Agrippa progresses to higher cognition in three stages. The first stage deals with the world as presented to the senses, with substances and with physical, chemical, and other forces. At this stage, he terms nature elemental. The second stage sees the world as a whole in its natural relationships and arrangements of everything related to measurement, number, weight, harmony, and so on. The first stage brings together the attributes that are closely related and looks for the causes of a phenomenon in its immediate environment. The second stage looks at a single phenomenon in relation to the cosmic whole. Agrippa posits the idea that each thing is under the influence of all the remaining things of the cosmic whole. This universal whole appears as a great harmony, of which every individual entity is a part. Seen from this perspective, the world is designated by Agrippa as the astral or celestial world. The third stage of cognition is where spirit, through immersion in itself, looks directly at spirit, the primordial essence of the world. Here Agrippa speaks of the, quote, spiritual soul, close quote, world. The views developed by Agrippa about the world and the human relationship to it may be encountered in a similar form in Theophrastus Paracelsus, where they are more complete and thus better considered in that work. Paracelsus characterized himself when he wrote under his portrait, quote, no one who can stand alone should be the servant of another, close quote. His whole position with regard to cognition is given in these words. He himself wanted to go back to the foundations of natural science in order to ascend through his own powers to the highest regions of cognition. As a physician, he did not want to simply accept, like his contemporaries, what the old investigators had affirmed in the past, though they were considered authorities at the time, parenthesis Galen and Ibn Sina, for example, close parenthesis. Footnote Claudius Galen, 129-199, Greek physician to gladiators in Pergamum and to the court of Rome of Marcus Aurelius, considered founder of experimental physiology, and demonstrated that arteries carry blood rather than air. Ibn Sina, also called Avicenna, 980-1037, Islamic scientist and philosopher from Bukhara in Uzbekistan, became court physician to Buyid, Prince Shams al-Dala in Hamadan in Iran. Renowned for his science and medical skills, he wrote numerous works on science, language, religion, and philosophy. End of footnote. Paracelsus wanted to read directly in the Book of Nature, quote, physicians must completely examine nature, which is the world and all its causation. And the lessons of nature must be committed to their wisdom, seeking nothing in their own wisdom but only in the light of nature. Close quote. He did not retreat from anything in his efforts to know nature and its manifestations from every aspect. For this purpose he traveled to Sweden, Hungary, Spain, Portugal, and the East. He was able to say, quote, I have pursued the art despite danger to my life, and I have not been ashamed to learn from passers-by, hangmen, and barbers. My teachings have been tested more severely than silver through poverty, anxiety, wars, and perils. Close quote. Knowledge passed down from old authorities held no value for him. He believed that he could gain the correct view only by experiencing for himself the ascent from natural science to the highest cognition. He boldly articulated his experience, quote, one who wants to pursue the truth must come into my realm. After me, not I, after you. Ibn Sina, Rhazes, Galen, Mazur. After me, and not I, after you. You of Paris, you of Montpellier, you of Swabia, you of Meissen, you of Cologne, you of Vienna, and whatever lies on the Danube and the River Rhine, you islands in the sea, you Italy, you Dalmatia, you Athens, you Greek, you Arab, you Israelite, after me, and not I after you. Mine is the realm." Close quote. It is easy to misinterpret Paracelsus because of his rough exterior, which sometimes hides his deep seriousness behind jest. He himself states, quote, "Nature has not made me subtle, nor have I been raised on figs and white bread, but on cheese, milk, and oat bread. Therefore I may well be uncivil to the excessively clean and overly refined. Understanding is difficult between those brought up in soft clothes and those of us who were brought up among fir cones. I must seem rough, though to myself I appear gracious. How can I not be strange for one who has never gone wandering in the sun?" Close quote. Goethe has beautifully described the relationship between humankind and nature in his book on Winckelmann, quote, "When healthy human nature acts holistically, when people have a sense of themselves in a world that is a great, beautiful, noble, and valuable whole, when harmonious ease affords them pure and free delight, then the universe, if it could experience itself, would exult as having attained its goal and admire the climax of its own becoming and essence." Close quote. Paracelsus is deeply imbued with the sentiment expressed in such statements. From such sentiment the human mystery takes shape for him. Now, let us consider how this happens in Paracelsus's sense. Initially, the road that nature took to produce its highest achievement is hidden from human powers of comprehension. Nature has attained a climax, but this climax does not say, "I experience myself as the whole of nature," but rather, "I feel like an individual human being." What, in fact, is an act of the whole world that comprehends itself as a single, solitary being standing alone? Indeed, this is true human nature, that we must consider ourselves something other than what we are. And if this is a contradiction, then the human being can be called a contradiction come to life. In their own way, people are the world. They view their harmony with the world as a duality. They are the same as the world, but repetitious, individuated beings. This view is the contrast that Paracelsus perceives as microcosm, human being, and macrocosm, universe. For him, the human being is the world, writ small. Spirit causes human beings to regard their relationship with the world in this way. Spirit seems bound to a single being, to one organism. In its whole nature, this organism belongs to the great chain of the universe. It is a link in the chain and exists only in relation to all other beings. Spirit, however, seems to be a result of a single organism. At first, it sees itself as connected only with this organism. It tears the organism from the native soil from which it grew. According to Paracelsus, there is a deep connection between the human being and the entire universe that is hidden in the natural foundation of existence. A connection obscured by the presence of spirit. Spirit leads us to higher cognition by communicating knowledge to us and by bringing that knowledge to rebirth on a higher level. Its initial effect, however, is to mask for us our own connection with the universe. Paracelsus saw that human nature initially falls into three classifications. The first is our sensory and corporeal nature, the organism that appears to us as a natural being among other natural beings, essentially no different than other natural beings. The second component is our hidden nature. This is a link in the chain of the whole world, and is consequently not enclosed within our organism. Rather, influences are sent and received between it and the whole universe. The third division is the highest nature, our spirit. It lives only in a spiritual way. Paracelsus calls the first part of human nature the elemental body. The second he terms the ethereal, celestial, or astral body, and the third part he calls soul. Paracelsus sees astral phenomena as an intermediate level between purely corporeal phenomena and the true soul phenomena. Spirit conceals that natural foundation of our existence, but once it ceases its activity, such phenomena will become visible. The simplest manifestation of this realm may be seen in the dream world. The images that flit through our dreams, with their peculiar and significant connections with the events in our environment and with our inner states, are produced by our natural foundation and obscured by the soul's brighter light. If a chair collapses near my bed, I may dream a whole drama, ending with a gunshot in a duel. Or my heart may begin to pound, and I dream of a red-hot stove. Meaningful and significant natural manifestations appear to reveal a life that exists between purely organic functions and the thinking processes in spirit's bright consciousness. Related to this are all the phenomena of hypnotism and suggestion. In suggestion, we can see the effect of one human being on another, which points to a relationship between natural beings that is obscured by the higher activity of spirit. Thus it becomes possible to understand what Paracelsus describes as an astral body. It is the collection of natural influences to which we are exposed, or to which we can be exposed through special circumstances. These emanate from us without the involvement of our soul, nor may they be considered purely physical phenomena. In this area, Paracelsus enumerates facts that we doubt today, but this is really unimportant when viewed from the perspective I have presented. Based on such views of human nature, Paracelsus divides human nature into 7 aspects. They are the same as those we find in the teachings of the ancient Egyptians, the Neoplatonists, and the Kabbalah. Human beings are first of all physical, bodily beings. Consequently, we are subject to the same laws to which any body is subject. In a sense, they are purely elemental bodies. Purely corporeal, physical laws combine in the process of organic life. Paracelsus designates the organic laws archaeus, or spiritus vitae. The organic raises itself to spirit-like manifestations that are not yet spirit. These are the astral manifestations. The functions of the animal spirit emerge from the astral processes. People are sensory beings, combining their sensory impressions through reason. Thus the intellectual, rational soul awakens in them. They immerse themselves in their own spiritual effects. They learn to recognize spirit as spirit. In this way, they raise themselves to the level of the spiritual soul. Finally, they understand that in this spiritual soul, they experience the deepest stratum of universal existence. The spiritual soul is no longer individual and separate. This is the insight to which Eckhart referred when he felt that it was no longer he who spoke, but primordial essence. Now, a condition prevails in which universal spirit regards itself in the human being. Paracelsus expressed with simplicity the feeling aroused by this condition, quote, "And this, which you must consider, is something great. There is nothing in heaven nor on earth that is not contained in the human being. And God, who is in heaven, is in the human being." Close quote. It is only the facts of inner and outer experience that Paracelsus wants to express through the 7 fundamental aspects of human nature. For human experience, this plurality of 7 parts is, in higher reality, a unity. Paracelsus does not question this. Higher cognition exists precisely to show the unity in everything that, to immediate experience, seems to us a plurality, because of our bodily and spiritual organization. On the level of the highest knowing, Paracelsus strives to fuse the world's living, uniform, primordial essence with spirit. He knows, however, that people can know nature spiritually only when they enter immediate communion with it. People do not come to understand nature by populating it themselves with arbitrarily assumed spiritual entities, but by accepting and valuing it as nature. Paracelsus, therefore, does not look for God or spirit in nature. For him, nature, as it presents itself to his eye, EYE, is immediately divine. Must one first attribute to the plant a soul like the human soul to find spirit? Paracelsus explains the development of phenomena, parenthesis, to the degree that this is possible with the scientific resources of his time, close parenthesis, in such a way that he regards this development entirely a sensory process of nature. He lets everything arise from primordial matter, primordial water, iliaster, and he regards as a further process of nature the separation of primordial matter, which he also calls the great limbo, into the four elements of water, earth, fire, and air. When he says that divine word invoked the multiplicity of beings from primordial matter, this should be understood in somewhat the same way that contemporary natural science understands the relationship between force and matter. A, in quotes, spirit in the real sense is not yet present on this level. Spirit is not a cause of the natural process, but a result of this process. It does not create nature, but develops from it. Much of what Paracelsus says could be interpreted in the opposite sense. For example, he says, quote, "There is nothing corporeal that does not carry a living spirit hidden within it. All corporeal and substantial things have life, not just those that stir and move, such as people and animals, the worms in the earth, the birds in the sky, and the fish in the water." Close quote. Paracelsus uses such sayings only to warn against a superficial view of nature that believes one can exhaust the nature of a phenomenon with a few forced concepts, to use Goethe's apt expression. His intention is not to inject things with an invented quality, but to promote the movement of our human faculties to produce the reality within a phenomenon. It is important not to be misled by the fact that Paracelsus expresses himself in the spirit of his time. Instead, one should try to understand what he has in mind when, viewing nature, he presents his ideas in the expressions of his time. For example, he ascribes to the human being a twofold flesh, that is, a twofold corporeal constitution. Quote, "The flesh must be understood to be of two kinds, the flesh whose origin is in Adam, and the flesh that is not from Adam. The flesh from Adam is coarse flesh, because it is earthly and only flesh, to be bound and grasped like wood and stone. The other flesh is not from Adam, it is subtle flesh, not to be bound or grasped, because it is not made of earth." Close quote. What is the flesh that comes from Adam? It is all that has come down to us through natural development, which we have thus inherited. Added to all this, in the course of time, all that we have acquired through interacting with our environment. Our contemporary scientific concepts of inherited characteristics, and those acquired through adaptation, arose from the thinking of Paracelsus. The, quote, "subtler flesh," close quote, which makes us capable of spiritual activities, has not been present in human beings from the beginning. They were of coarse flesh, like the animals, a flesh that can be bound and grasped like wood and stone. Consequently, in the scientific sense, the soul is also a characteristic acquired by this coarse flesh. When scientists of the 19th century speak of the inheritances from the animal world, they mean what Paracelsus meant by his expression, "the flesh that came from Adam." These remarks, of course, are not intended to eliminate the difference between a natural scientist of the 16th century and those of the 19th century. After all, It was only in the 19th century that we gained the ability to see in a fully scientific sense the forms of living organisms, so that their relationship in nature and true derivation in connections with the human being became evident. Science sees only a natural process, whereas Linnaeus in the 18th century still saw a spiritual process. He characterized in this way, quote, "There are as many species of living organisms as there were in principle forms that were created." Close quote. Footnote: Carolus Linnaeus, titled Genera Plantarum, Frankfurt, 1789. Page 12, Linnaeus or Carl von Linne, 1707 to 1778. Swedish botanist and founder of modern systematic botany, became lecturer at Uppsala and explored Lapland. He was a medical doctor in Stockholm and a professor of medicine and botany, on which he wrote several works. End of footnote. Whereas Linnaeus had to shift spirit into the spatial world and assign it the task of producing spiritually or creating life forms, the natural scientist of the 19th century could attribute to nature what belongs to nature and to the spirit what belongs to spirit. Nature itself is given the task of explaining its creations, and the spirit can immerse itself in itself, where it alone may be found, within the human being. In a certain sense, Paracelsus thinks very much in the spirit of his time. Yet it is exactly in terms of the idea of development, or becoming, that he profoundly comprehended the relationship between the human being and nature. He did not see existing finished work in the world's primordial essence. He grasped instead the divinity in its becoming. Consequently, he could in truth ascribe self-creating activity to the human being. If divine primordial essence exists, once and for all a true creation of the human being is out of the question. Then it is not the human being living in time who creates, but God, who is eternal. For him there is only eternal becoming, and the human being is a link in this eternal becoming. Anything the human being forms did not exist previously in any way. Whatever human beings create, as they create it, is an original creation. It can be called divine only in the sense that it exists as a human creation. Accordingly, in terms of cosmic creation, Paracelsus can assign a role to human beings that makes them co-architects in this creation. Divine primordial essence is not the same without the human being. Quote, "Nature brings forth nothing into the light of day, complete as it stands. Rather, human beings must complete it." Close quote. The self-creating activity of the human being in the building of nature, Paracelsus calls alchemy. Quote, "This completion is alchemy. Alchemists are bakers when they bake bread, vintagers when they make wine, weavers when they make the cloth." Close quote. Paracelsus wants to be an alchemist in his field as a physician. Quote, "I may fittingly write so much here about alchemy that you learn it well and know what it is and how it is to be understood, and not be annoyed that it is not intended to bring you gold or silver. Rather see that the secrets are revealed to you. The third pillar of medicine is alchemy, since remedies cannot be prepared without it, because nature cannot be put to use without art." Close quote. Paracelsus's eyes are directed in the strictest sense at nature, in order to discover from nature itself what it says about its products. He intends to investigate the laws of chemistry, so that he can work in this sense as an alchemist. He considers all bodies to be composed of three basic substances, salt, sulfur, and mercury. Paracelsus identifies salt, sulfur, and mercury, of course, not as corresponding to the names used later by chemistry, any more than he considers basic substance to be that of later chemistry. Various things are designated by the same names at different times. the ancients designated phenomena according to the four elements, earth, water, air, and fire, and these are still with us. We no longer call them elements, but states of aggregation, which we term solid, liquid, gaseous, and ethereal. For example, for the ancients, earth did not refer to the earth, but to solidity. We can also recognize the three basic substances of Paracelsus in contemporary concepts, but not using similar contemporary terms. Paracelsus uses the two important chemical processes of liquid solution and combustion. When a body is dissolved or burned, it is decomposed into its parts. A portion remains as residue, and another portion is dissolved or burned. He saw the residue as saline, the liquid soluble as mercurial, and the combustible as sulfurous. Such natural processes may leave us cold if we fail to look beyond them, as we might by anything material and prosaic. Those who at all costs want to apprehend spirit through the senses will attribute all sorts of spiritual entities to those processes. Like Paracelsus, however, anyone who knows how to view such processes in relation to the universe, which reveals its secret within the human being, accepts those processes as they are presented to the senses. Such a person does not begin by reinterpreting them, because those natural processes, as they confront us with their sensory reality, reveal in their own way the mystery of existence. Those who struggle for the light of higher knowledge, through this sensory reality, these processes reveal something out of the human soul that exists at a higher level, higher than all the paranormal wonders related to the so-called spirit that people devise or may have revealed to them. When the soul unites with that nature in friendship and in intimate communication, heeds the revelations of its secrets, there is no spirit of nature that can express any higher truths than those revealed by the great works of nature themselves. Paracelsus sought that kind of friendship with nature. The end of section 5.